It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk about Attorney General Eric Holder's recent comments about the U.S. Department of Justice getting involved in the legal fight over Wisconsin's voter ID law.
But first, fashion photographer Rick Guadagni was photographing what were considered the world's most attractive people when an incident completely changed his way of looking at beauty. He's been working for the past 15 years to change commonly held attitudes toward the way we look and to raise awareness of the social and psychological experiences of people with genetic, physical, and cognitive differences.
Rick Guadagni joins us now from New York. He's an award-winning former fashion photographer, and he's the founder and director of Positive Exposure. That's an arts, education, and advocacy organization that works with individuals who live with genetic and other conditions. Rick, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, great. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you.
We mentioned the moment. Tell us about the pivotal moment when you decided to shift to who you photograph and what you did with your life.
Oh, it's actually after a big casting, actually, seeing lots of models for a certain shoot that I was about to do, and I was leaving my studio, which is here in New York City, and walking down Park Avenue. I spotted a young woman waiting for the bus at the corner at Park and 20th Street, and she didn't have pigmentation in her hair, her skin, or her eyes. She had a genetic condition called albinism, or the common term was albino that I knew at that point. And she was so beautiful, and yet I realized that she had never been included in that beauty standard. And she was so gorgeous. But when I went to look through medical textbooks to get any information I could about this genetic condition, to see images of this gorgeous kid and her friends with the same condition, I only found really horrible, stark medical-type photographs of kids up against walls in doctor's offices with those black bars across their eyes, looking like diseases, looking like medical diagnoses. They were not people. I didn't see one photograph of this gorgeous kid, there were just all these scary images of despair.
And this started you thinking, I gather, about what we mean by beauty when we think about it, when we look at it.
Sure. Well, prior to that, I was, as a fashion photographer, working here in New York and living in Paris and working in Milan, and just always being told who was beautiful. And I was constantly told who the model of the moment was, and that would change each season. And as a fashion photographer, I would follow all that direction. But, as an artist, though, I didn't see beauty just on covers of magazines. I saw beauty everywhere. So seeing this girl was so exciting, to see beauty outside of the industry standards or the parameters of the beauty standard.
So you decided to find new subjects for photographs.
Yes.
What did you want to accomplish?
Well, I wanted to see beauty outside of the parameters of the beauty standard. I wanted the beauty industry to see beauty not existing just on the covers of those magazines, to see beauty in someone with albinism, to see beauty in diversity, to see beauty in human difference. And so when I went to research and to find people to photograph, I contacted an organization which was called NOAA, the National Organization for Albinism and Hypopigmentation. It's a support group for people living with this condition and their families. And I called them saying, hey, I'm a fashion photographer. Let's show the world the beauty of albinism. This is going to be amazing. This is going to be so much fun. And at first they told me to go away. They made it very clear to me about their fear of exploitation.
Oh, yeah,
and every
yeah.
time a magazine article came out about a person with albinism, it was always about a victim, always negative, sensational, exploitative. And I couldn't agree more, because that's all I could find was all this negative, negative imagery in medical and encyclopedias, and everywhere that I looked, I would only find those negative images. So at first they said no, but I said, well, let's kind of form a non-traditional partnership, a fashion photographer, a genetic support group, and together we can create something really magnificent in seeing the beauty in albinism, the beauty in human diversity, and that's how we partnered.
As a photographer, how did you approach this in a way saying, okay, I don't want to be clinical, like the medical textbooks you mentioned. I don't want to be exploitative, like the media coverage I've seen. How do you do that? How do you walk that line?
Well, as a fashion photographer or as an artist, my whole interest, my whole focus has always been on beauty and creating an opportunity to see beauty just to see beauty, to create an environment where beauty can really shine and beauty exists in an incredible, almost tangible way. So from photographing Cindy Crawford to photographing the first person with albinism, nothing changed. I was exactly the same photographer. It was allowing that moment, that environment to kind of accept and celebrate that beauty. And so the first person that I photographed walked into my studio completely hunched over, head down, no eye contact, because of the teasing and the abuse because of her difference, which caught me completely off guard because I was so excited to photograph albinism and to show the world the beauty in albinism. And in walks this beautiful girl who had zero self-esteem because of the abuse she experienced every single day. So that changed so many things for me right then and there. And I thought, oh, man, how am I going to photograph this kid? She's so vulnerable. But just the day before, I had photographed a Revlon shoot with Cindy Crawford on the same set in my studio. And I thought, you know, out of respect for this gorgeous kid, I'm going to photograph her like I did yesterday with Cindy or any other model. The fan went on, the music went on, and I picked up a mirror and I just held it up to her. And I said, Christina, look at yourself. You're magnificent. And she saw it. And it, her, she broke, her hands went on her hips, her head went in the air, and this smile came across her face that lit up all of New York City. It was amazing. And that's how this really started, to really, not only to see beauty, but it created a slogan or a motto that everything that we do here at Positive Exposure and that I live by is that change how you see how you change. It just creates all these opportunities for people to see themselves, to see that reflection of all of us, and to see what is reflected back at us, all those great parts, and to celebrate that and to see beauty in that.
How do we recalibrate our mind to change our definition of beauty, to see it in people we usually wouldn't see it in, and maybe in ourselves, if we're one of your subjects here?
Well, see, so often when you see somebody walking down the street that has a physical difference or has some sort of a difference, and they're walking toward you, you either, as the public, as anybody on the street, they're not having any information about that difference, either you stare or you look away. Well, that looking away is actually even more painful at times than the actual stares for an individual living with a difference. So what I do through photography and using the arts is to create opportunities for the public to steady their gaze long enough to see beauty in that difference. And then once you see that, then you see around that to what we share, which is humanity. And it's creating these opportunities to kind of change the way that you see beauty. Change how you see how you change. You see that once you see this beauty in difference, you're overwhelmed by it, and you stay enlightened, and you start seeing beauty in other places. And this is and this is through Positive Exposure, but this is also part of a huge human movement. No one wants to be seen as a disease or diagnosis. Everyone wants to be seen as a human being. And what I do as a former fashion photographer, but as an artist, to really show the beauty in that diversity.
You started with people with the condition of albinism.
Yes,
you didn't
right.
stop there, though. Where did you go next?
Well, I the first images were in Life magazine several years ago, and it was a really great honor. It was a cover story. It was fantastic. And I started traveling around the world photographing people with this condition, but I also received an award, the Art of Reporting Award, from an organization called the Genetic Alliance. And the Genetic Alliance is a coalition of all the genetic support groups worldwide, and they're based in D.C. It's an amazing organization. It's providing support for the actual genetic support groups themselves and family support groups themselves. And this award it was just wonderful. It was really great. It was my first big accolade from this program or project. And the director at the time said to me, I'm looking at these beautiful photographs of people with albinism from around the world. But, you know, actually, you know, there's a universal message here. This is a message about celebrating all differences. Would you come to some of our family conferences and meet some of our gorgeous kids that don't have albinism but have other genetic conditions, that they too can celebrate their difference and have their families see the beauty in their gorgeous kids. So I went to my first conference, which was in San Antonio, which is for kids and adults living with a chromosome 18 anomaly. When you have an anomaly on your 18th chromosome, but not knowing what that was, you know, I ran back to those medical textbooks and found horrible images of kids with cleft palates and kids with feeding tubes and trachs and kids with mobility issues. And they were horrible images. Again, I'm thinking, you know, albinism was so easy, but this is going to be tough. But I committed, and I went, and I walked into this auditorium where all these kids and young adults were being entertained. And I opened the door, and I was surrounded. I had these horrible images burned in my head, by the way. But I walked into this room and was instantly surrounded by kids screaming with laughter, They were kids. First, if there were those giggles in those photographs, there were kids with clefts and palates and kids with trachs and feeding tubes and mobility issues. But first and foremost, they were huge. They were kids, and they were amazing. And I just fell in love with them all, and I started going. I go back to this conference constantly. But it was actually after arriving back to New York City after that experience at the Chromosome 18 conference, I was approached by the National Human Genome Research Institute, the National Institute of Health, to create an exhibition commemorating the People's Genome Celebration that was going to premiere at the Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C. And I just, you know, that was to show albinism worldwide, to show diversity within the heterogeneity within albinism or that diagnosis, and to show albinism worldwide in Fiji and Africa and Asia and Malaysia. And I said, this is great, but, you know, I just came back from this amazing conference in San Antonio, this Chromosome 18 Registry and Research Society, where I met these beautiful kids, very stark contrast to the images in medical textbooks. These kids, look at these photographs. I said, let's invite other genetic support groups to participate in this exhibition, and sure enough, everybody wanted to be part of it. So then I started working with, we created that exhibition that launched, and then continued to work with all these great organizations, and now I find myself, you know, this former fashion photographer doing grand rounds in hospitals and speaking to medical students at medical schools around the world, and creating exhibitions and as the public exhibitions that really kind of create opportunities for the public to see beauty in difference, to not see a disease, not see a diagnosis, but a human being. And that's also the same in medical school. We have so many programs like the FRAME Project, which is Faces Redefining the Art of Medical Education, creating opportunities for the individuals themselves to explain the basic characteristics of their particular condition to healthcare providers in training. PEARLS Project, Kids Positive Exposures Ambassadors, Real Life Stories, kids blogging about their lives and their experiences, sharing and networking their everyday experiences, not just talking about their difference, but starting this dialogue, this conversation every day. Every day is an opportunity to talk about diversity, to really talk about and have new understandings each day about what diversity really does and truly means.
And Rick, we'll get into those programs a bit more in a moment. So we'll continue our conversation about reframing beauty with photographer Rick Guidotti in just a moment.
And we'd love to hear from you. Do the media images that you see, do you think that they we absorb that we create an unrealistic and even unhealthy view of what's beautiful? How has society's notions of attractiveness affected your life and those close to you? Do you have a genetic or other condition that makes people look at you as different? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on our Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about changing our idea of what beauty is. We've got a former fashion photographer, Rick Guidotti. He's now actively working to highlight the psychological, the societal experiences of people living with genetic anomalies and trying to photograph them as humans, not diseases, not people who are different.
What's your reaction? What questions do you have? Do you have a genetic or other condition that makes people, that has made people look at you as different? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
Before we go to the phones, Rick, I want to ask, you're there maybe with a family and a kid. You've done these pictures. They're looking at the pictures, maybe for the first time seeing pictures outside of that clinical setting you were talking about earlier. What kind of reactions have you heard from the families?
It's extraordinary. It happens every time. It's having a mom have her child seen publicly the way she sees him. Not the way everybody else sees him, but the way that she sees him. And it's so celebratory. It's so powerful. It's so inspiring. And empowering to really see beauty in that difference and allow a family or an individual to look at their reflection and see what that reflection has and is holding, and it's something that's good and something that's beautiful. Different maybe, and that's okay.
We'll go to our callers now. We've got April on the line in New Glarus. April, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious and like, who defines normal and who defines beautiful? And, you know, why is this okay in our society that, you know, these beautiful skinny actresses are, you know, hairless no facial hair and super thin. And, you know, I definitely have facial hair and people, I just wear it. And same thing with my armpits and my legs. And why are we so scared of like this thing that is part of us? When did this start becoming normal? So just something I think about often in kids, I get a lot of reaction from kids, you know, they stare at me and they're like, oh, that woman has, you know, hair on her lip and on her chin. But I know I'm beautiful and I have lots of people that love me and
gorgeous.
Think I'm brave and beautiful too. So
April, thanks for the call. Rick, your thoughts.
My thoughts on that is, you know, first of all, I think why that size one model on the cover of all these magazines is actually spent hours and hours in hair and makeup and then retouched for 3 or 4 days, where that person doesn't really even look like that photograph. It's an industry that's selling product. It's an industry. It's it's a powerful industry that's selling product and that dream, and somehow we believe that that is the dream, and it's about time that I believe that we all think for ourselves and creating exhibitions through like positive exposure, but also listening to other April just now, and listening to the people that are in power with not, you know, bucking that system and saying, you know, I don't really want to fit into those the parameters of that beauty standard. I'm going to create my own, and that's what this is about. It's about being able to accept difference and see beauty in that, and not that kind of dictated beauty that we find constantly shoved at us on every coffee table, every magazine stand.
Thanks for the call, April. We'll go to Sandy now in Rhinelander. Sandy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. There are many members of my family that have piebaldism, which sure. is partial albinism.
Sure.
And so, you know, our hair, like the forelock of our hair is snow white. And then the rest of our hair, you know, it could be blonde or brown or black. And then, you know, there are parts of our skin that have no pigments. So those patches are completely white. They never tan or they're always just white. And so especially in the summer when the other parts of the skin tan, it's very noticeable.
Sure. Comes even more contrast, sure.
Yeah. And, you know, as a child in particular, it was very difficult because kids are mean. They get teased
sure,
a lot.
Sure.
And then there was always, you know, people would say, what happened to you? And it's like, nothing happened to me. I just
sure.
don't have pigment in parts
sure.
of my
And Sandy,
skin.
Now head held high?
Yeah, as an adult, you know, my mom in particular, even though it comes from my dad's side, my mom was really supportive and reaffirming that there is nothing else wrong with you. You can walk, you can run, you can, you know, you're fine and you're just as good as everyone else. And so as an adult, especially, I guess, in the era where everybody dyes their hair and people, you know, found it to be very striking and, you know, lovely.
Sandy, I want to jump in because we're just about out of time, and I want to give Rick a chance to respond. Do you hope more, you know, moms like Sandy's are getting this message and communicating that to their kids, whatever the condition we're talking about?
Absolutely, without question. And the idea is that to create the tools that are needed for advocacy, for self-advocacy, for the parent themselves to help that child see beauty in their difference, but also to create other opportunities for the individual who is reacting negatively to someone who has a difference. Give them also the tools that they need, the tools to also see beyond what they're just told. Oh, that's different. I have to look away. That's awful. It's too different. I am not supposed to accept that. I'm supposed to only accept this. And so we have to create opportunities and lots of tools that we can place in the hands of our individuals living with difference, but also to our public and the broader public as well, to give them opportunities to accept the diversity, to accept and embrace diversity, to create a more inclusive society where all differences are celebrated.
You know, Rick, this just popped into my head. Is the next step getting the people you're taking pictures of getting cameras in their hands, taking pictures, selfies, and pictures of each
other.
Oh,
this that happens, and that's always happening. We're always promoting that and promoting, you know, especially with the, you know, we have Facebook, and it's about, again, creating opportunities to see that people can actually see and be more comfortable with someone living with a difference. So, yes, absolutely, putting cameras in people's hands, taking more photographs, people feeling empowered to say, you know, not hiding in the shadows, but standing up and be on the table, out in public, head held high, hair blowing in the wind, proud of your differences, absolutely proud of your differences.
Is this making an impact? Are you seeing a change in the people you talk to?
Constantly. Constantly. And not only have I seen the impact in individuals themselves, but in families, in communities, in schools, in healthcare practices. It goes across the board.
Amazing. Rick, thank you so much for joining us. Hope we can talk to you again sometime.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
We've been talking to Rick Guidotti. He's an award-winning former fashion photographer. He's the founder of Positive Exposure. That's an arts, education, and advocacy organization that changes our image of beauty. It works with individuals who live with genetic and other observable differences.
It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, in a recent interview with ABC News, United States Attorney General Eric Holder said the Department of Justice is expected to get involved in two court challenges involving states and voter ID laws, including one here in Wisconsin.
The Justice Department has already intervened in similar cases challenging voting laws in Texas and North Carolina. With Wisconsin expected to join that list, there's been a lot of speculation as to what could happen and when it might happen.
Here to talk about this story is Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know so far about the possible DOJ involvement in Wisconsin's battle over voter ID here?
Not too much. I mean, it's something that Eric Holder has mentioned in passing in that ABC News interview that you referenced there. ABC News talked about it a little bit in their reporting, and then in a transcript of the interview that was released by the U.S. Department of Justice, Holder said, quote, "We have already filed suit in Texas and North Carolina. I expect we're going to be filing in cases that are already in existence in Wisconsin as well as in Ohio." So that's about the extent that we know about it, although we have heard Eric Holder mention Wisconsin in recent weeks, too. He had a video message on the DOJ website that singled out Wisconsin and the federal lawsuit in Wisconsin that put Wisconsin's voter ID law on hold for now.
And if he were to go forward with this, on what grounds can he file a lawsuit or move forward with this?
Well, that particular lawsuit that he's referencing struck down Wisconsin's law based on a couple of factors, on the grounds that it violated the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and that it violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The Section 2 challenge was kind of groundbreaking when it comes to how lawsuits have attacked voting laws like the one in Wisconsin. And that's a section of the Voting Rights Act that prohibits voting practices that discriminate on the basis of race. Traditionally, the Department of Justice, you know, under Holder and under previous attorneys general, would enforce voting laws in southern states in particular using other sections of the Voting Rights Act. But when Section 4 of the Act was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, kind of left people wondering, left the Department of Justice wondering how they would, exercise authority in the future. Seems like from Eric Holder's comments that they like what they've seen with the Wisconsin lawsuit, and they might be joining it.
Yeah, definitely a lot of layers to this discussion. And at the same time, there's been some response, at least from our state attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen. What did he say?
Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, in a written statement, said that he referenced a lot of the news regarding immigration that's going on at the national front right now, said, quote, "Maybe Mr. Holder should take his army of lawyers and start enforcing our nation's immigration laws." Attorney General Van Hollen went on to say, quote, "At a time when an immigration crisis is rattling the nation, the attorney general is choosing to spend taxpayer money to meddle in a state law that does nothing more than ask a voter to show a photo ID." So, general on general violence there. We've got taking aim at each other.
Well, and that last statement stood out to me too. So the as AG Van Hollen put it, we're simply asking people to present a vote, an ID when they vote. Seems very simple and straightforward. And yet the dialogue around the issue has extended to voting rights and to the possibility of racial discrimination, as pointed out by Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. How did it evolve to get to be such a large issue here?
I think it's been a large issue for a while now. This is something that Republicans have pushed for quite a while. They came to power in 2011, and it was one of the, you know, one of the first bills that they passed after the battle over Act 10, and it was very quickly blocked by state courts. A couple of Dane County judges blocked voter ID. This federal lawsuit took longer to proceed, but it's a big one, and it's now in the hands of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And I think what it really, you know, what the issue really boils down to is, at least in this lawsuit, the way that they've framed it, is that the state, in this case, Republican lawmakers and the governor, have not been able to point to cases of voter fraud that would be remedied by a voter ID law. And so they contend there's not there's no grounds for having a law like this when statistics have shown that it's going to, you know, it's going to drive down turnout. It's going to make it hard for some people to get those IDs. And, you know, in practice, they're not going to get them. So that's sort of the argument going forward. And there have been some signs that the appeals court, at least one of the judges on the appeals court in Chicago that could hear this case, that there's been sort of a change of heart in terms of the way that they look at voter ID. We'll see if that's reflected in any decisions as this thing moves.
A change of heart on account of what?
Just as more evidence has come out. Mm-hmm. It was Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit who said, and he's somebody who authored the court decision out of the Seventh Circuit that upheld Indiana's voter ID law. And Judge Posner had mentioned that, you know, as the evidence has come out, he's looked at the issue differently. And that, you know, it sort of signaled that future voter ID challenges might be looked at through a different lens.
Is it at all odd or inappropriate for the federal attorney general, the U.S. attorney general, to step in to a state level issue such as this?
Well, it seems like Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen thinks it's mm-hmm. inappropriate for Eric Holder to step into a state level issue. But I don't think it's all that unusual. I mean, I think the Department of Justice gets involved in these cases from time to time. It's a little more unusual in that the Department of Justice's authority when it comes to voting laws used to be more focused on southern states or states, I guess, with when the Voting Rights Act was initially passed, states that had more of a history of discrimination. So those were the Section 5 states, they were called. So this is a little bit different in that regard. But as far as the DOJ, the U.S. DOJ getting involved in cases, that's kind of their prerogative.
And have we heard any reaction yet from the ACLU?
I have not heard a reaction yet from the ACLU. I'm sure they'd be happy to have the Department of Justice on their side here. This is not something where it's just the Wisconsin ACLU versus the attorney general, though. They really do have quite, a cadre of attorneys who are working on this from national interest groups. I mean, there's a lot of big firms who have attorneys working with the ACLU on this on a pro bono basis. So I think they'll be happy to have more help, but it's not like they're lacking for help right now.
Mm-hmm. So what would you have a sense of what could happen next?
I think what happens next is we wait for the appeal process to move forward. It's probably not going to move all that quickly. And we have other cases that are going to move quickly. There's a lot of cases in the pipeline right now. For example, the gay marriage lawsuit. That's something that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has said they're going to hear oral arguments on that in August. So that one's moving very quickly. Mm-hmm. This one, possibly not so much because you don't have the same circumstances. In the gay marriage issue, you have states all over the country where these lawsuits are popping up, very similar lawsuits everywhere. And so these courts of appeals are trying to expedite the appeals, get them to the Supreme Court, which is going to make the final call on this. I don't know what's going to happen on voter ID, but I think it's a different issue.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, joining us from the state capitol.
It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Congress has just 11 work days left before the August recess. And while the influx of young immigrants at the border is being called a crisis, a compromise on immigration seems elusive.
Meanwhile, Democrats in the Senate and Republicans in the House are working on issues that are not expected to make any progress. For Democrats, it's legislation that would undo the Supreme Court's recent Hobby Lobby ruling. And for Republicans, it's a hearing on their plan to sue President Obama for delaying the Affordable Care Act's employer mandate.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Nice to be with you, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
All right.
Well,
waiting for them to leave.
Yeah, this immigration thing now, we've talked about this a lot in the past months. You've said probably nothing is going to happen in this session of Congress. The issue is heating up. All these youth from Central America on the border, more people in polls rating immigration as a top issue. What are both sides pushing for? Is there any room for real compromise?
Yeah, well, now we've moved off the issue of an actual immigration bill that sort of, alters, amends, or changes federal law. Mm. Now what we're into is a very narrow piece of legislation to provide emergency funding to a bunch of agencies to respond to the crisis of these unaccompanied children flowing across the border. They've had something like 40 or 50,000 kids from Central America turning themselves in at the border, essentially looking for asylum in the U.S. And it's basically just overwhelming the system. And so President Obama's asked for $3.7 billion, I believe, of kind of emergency funding to handle these kids, send a bunch of judges and lawyers down there to process them and send them back. The Republicans have said essentially, well, if you're going to get any extra money, we want a change in law that will allow you to basically deport them much more quickly. Mm. There's a whole bunch of technical reasons why under existing law, you can basically grab a kid or any illegal immigrant at that point and just send them back to across the border if they come from Mexico or Canada.
Right.
If they come from somewhere further away, you got to go through this whole process. And basically the Republicans want to streamline that to get rid of these kids faster. We'll see. The White House has said they're interested in some similar law change, so it may not be an unbridgeable gap.
So the White House said they might be open to a faster send back without the full process that some Republicans are looking for?
Yeah, some version of that. That's right. The administration is willing to, in fact, at one point was going to ask for themselves a change to that law to sort of expand it so that children from other Central American countries could be deported more quickly, similarly to the way it's done for Mexican children. Again, the issue is you got these two parties that don't trust each other. Can they actually come to a deal? The Republicans still say they don't believe the Obama administration is going to implement this stuff the way they mean for him to. And they're very concerned that essentially what's going on is, with a wink, the administration is going to let these kids ultimately stay. They'll get some sort of asylum declaration that will let these kids stay. And that has been a concern of a lot of the Republican members.
Are they balking at the price tag here of $3.7 billion? I know Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin joins us on our show today. He's been saying lately it'd be a lot cheaper if we just did what we want to do, ship them back faster. We can do it at something like a tenth of the cost.
Right. Well, there's some balking at the cost, but I don't think the cost is really the big deal. Ultimately, it's going to be a couple of billion dollars one way or the other. I don't think it's going to be, the $300 million that Senator Johnson may be suggesting. But, there's going to be more money. It'll probably be less money than Obama is asking for. And I don't think anybody really disputes the notion that the agencies that are responding to this flood of kids need more money and just, even just to house them, and to provide more judges down there to process them. You just don't have enough people on the ground. So then the issue is going to become how much money, and that's still sort of up for dispute as well. They still think they're going to be able to get this done sometime in the next couple of weeks. We'll see.
Election year political calculations here?
Sure. For everybody. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that the idea of deporting these kids more quickly was something that the Obama administration had floated by themselves and immediately got pushback from immigration advocates and for immigrant rights groups who still, you know, will argue that Obama has, in fact, been setting historic records of deportation, despite the fact that he has rewritten some policies to make it easier for some kids to stay. So it's very tough. And of course, you know, I think ultimately nobody wants to look like we are simply turning our back on some kids who are coming from very, very rough circumstances and have been through a very traumatic experience. I mean, I think there is still on both sides an effort to extend as much humanitarian care as possible, even while upholding our immigration laws.
So that's something that might get accomplished in the next 10, 11 days. There's some legislation you're less or more skeptical about. Very justifiably, we heard just a little while ago that a Democratic Senate plan to turn around the Supreme Court's ruling, in effect, turn it around to the Hobby Lobby lawsuit on contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act. That's already been stifled within the Senate, hasn't it?
Yes. Which came as no surprise to anybody. These are the sort of things, and I know you and I have talked about this before on this program, that we call them message votes. You know, the Democrats wanted to make a point. The point being, we disagree with the Supreme Court, and we believe the Supreme Court has narrowed women's right to contraception, because the way this ruling works is it says that privately held companies can refuse to pay for some forms of contraception that refuse to provide insurance that covers some forms of contraception that they consider a violation of their religious tenets. So what the senators were trying to do was to pass a law that basically patches that, or a fix, as they were calling it, that would say, no, you have to provide, you know, all legal contraception. Your health insurance plan has to provide all legal contraception for your employees. You can't choose, as it were.
But even if it had somehow gotten through the Senate, wasn't going to go anywhere in the House.
Not a chance.
So this is a political messaging bill.
Yeah, and it's actually good. The funny thing about this one, it's good political messaging for both sides. Democrats can now go out and say, see, we tried to reinstate your right to choose and your right to contraception, and the Republicans blocked it. And the Republicans go out and say, see, the Democrats are trying to overturn your religious freedoms and force this, you know, whatever, contraception sort of thing down your throat. So, you know, both sides win. The only thing that, you know, it doesn't change any policy anywhere. No laws get passed.
And speaking of laws not getting passed, a lawsuit against President Obama, that's the effort from Republicans on the House side of things.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of that. I really don't. It's we thought originally they were going to sue Obama on the basis of, you know, a bunch of executive action he's been taking. Because he's been saying, I'm going to act without Congress. Ultimately, they boiled it down to one item, and that is Obama delaying the employer mandate to provide coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The thing is that, I mean, this is something that the Republicans had been asking for. They had wanted a bill passed to delay the mandate in the first place. So then Obama does it unilaterally, and now they're going to sue him for essentially not implementing the law. They apparently had a witness this afternoon testifying on this who explained why they could sue Obama for this, who had previously written an op-ed sometime earlier arguing they could not sue Obama for this. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't know what to make of it. It seems to me it is a long shot at best and a bit of a stunt.
One more thing we've talked about, I don't want to leave it behind, the Highway Trust Fund, long-term problem with how we pay for federal road maintenance. Something's going to get passed, but not the big thing.
Yeah, Congress will kick the can down the road, as they are good at doing. The House has passed a bill that will just basically extend the current trust fund through May. I believe the Senate's going to vote on another version of that probably early next week. And everybody will just grump harumph and pass the thing. The whole notion being that this gives us more time to work out a bigger deal, which, of course, is not really the truth. The truth is this will get us time to get past the elections and decide whether we're in better position to force our hand.
Do you know if states are complaining on this? Because they're probably trying to make long-term plans based around this funding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is Congress hearing it, do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the argument they get from just about everybody is that these 5, 6, 7 month extensions don't really help anybody very much because you can't plan for next year's construction season if your money's going to run out in May. You know, you guys up in Wisconsin, I doubt you've even moved a shovel by May. I mean, you probably start in, June and July.
Well, depends on the year, but yeah, it can happen.
Yeah, and you may not, at this point, there may not be any guarantee of money.
So some kind of short-term agreement looks very likely, though?
Yeah. Because otherwise the thing runs out, the trust fund runs out in like August, and that would be bad for everybody running into an election season.
All right, Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
Sure, we'll talk to you soon, Rob.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us this time every week to bring us up to date on the latest from Congress and the election politics relating thereto.